17, Coffee with Crime. I'm Lewis.
And I'm Alexi. It's been a while since we did an episode.
Mm-hmm.
It's been, what, 3 weeks almost?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But we are back.
So sorry, everyone. we've been busy and
just wanted to keep the suspense going. So you're really waiting for
we
every
wanted
episode.
To make you miss us.
Yes. Let us know how it works. Are we doing a good job of making you miss us? The coffee today is from a place called City of Saints, based in New Jersey. And I went about a little bit different way of getting this coffee today, as I usually talk about it in the podcast. I either buy it somewhere directly from a roaster, or I contact the roaster and say, hey, we've got this podcast. Would you be willing to send us some beans? And so it's always been a combination of that. But I may have mentioned this before, but the main way that I've found out about a lot of the roasters that we feature on the podcast is through a website called drinktrade.com. And they're a coffee subscription service, but they're not... A lot of the roasters do their own subscription service where they just... You can say how many bags of coffee you want every month, and then you pay for, you know, you just pay this... You get it sent to your house with whatever frequency you choose, and then they charge you for it. But DrinkTrade is kind of a liaison or a curator, I guess you could say, of coffees that are ethically sourced and are sustainably sourced and are really high quality and interesting and complex, and the kind of coffee that we like to do on this podcast. Third wave, some people call it third wave coffee, or high-end specialty coffee, whatever you want to call it. But that's how I have found out about a lot of the roasters that we have featured. And so what I did to get this coffee that we have today was actually signed up for like a trial subscription for drinktrade.com.
Oh, cool.
And I would encourage people listening to check it out, because they give you 50% off on your first order, and which is a really good deal. So, a lot of subscriptions of different kinds, not necessarily coffee, but maybe if you're getting like T-shirt subscription or a vinyl record subscription, a lot of times they don't give you the choice. They kind of surprise you, and that's the mystique of it and the surprise. But personally, I like the fact that they actually don't do that. They ask you all these questions about what kind of coffee you like, and then they give you a list of recommendations, and then you can click and say, I want this exact coffee because, you know, you recommended it, I researched it, and then I like this. So it is really very customizable, and you can be surprised if you want, and you can just not look at what they recommended.
Yeah.
But if you really want some control over what kind of coffee you're getting, it's really, really cool. They have over 400 different coffees that you can choose from, different coffee roasters. And you can even pause your subscription if you're going on vacation and you don't want to be getting, you know, coffee for the month of March, but you want to make sure that you're getting it after that. So you can change it whatever way you want. It's really, really cool. I just did the trial one for this episode because I wanted to see how it worked, but I was really happy with it. And I don't know if I will keep doing that because we've got other coffees coming from different places right now. But in the long term, I can see this as being a really cool option and honestly affordable. It's not, you know, because of the kind of coffee they're offering, you are paying a decent amount per bag. You're paying between, you know, 15 or like $16 and $22 per bag, but they don't charge shipping. So shipping
nice.
Is free,
yeah.
You know, and they still have to pay shipping. So I'm sure it's
right.
built.
But
considering the fact that really they're just a kind of a middleman and helping you find the coffee that you like, it really, I don't see much of a price difference between that and then walking into the store and then paying the price of the beans plus tax, you know?
Right. And then
it's really convenient.
That way you can like discover different coffees too that you didn't even know about.
And that's the whole appeal. So what we have today and what I chose was a coffee called City of Saints out of New Jersey. Like I said, and what we got.
It smells really good.
Yeah, it does. Cannot wait to start drinking this. And this is from the Baroida Estate. It's the Eastern Highlands of Papua New Guinea, all the way over close to Australia. So this is a coffee from very, very far away. which is where it was grown. Very simple, minimalistic, but sleek and modern presentation with a white bag, 12-ounce bag with a logo with a thumbs up that says City of Saints Coffee Roasters, drink what you like. So I like that simplicity of like, hey, you know,
yeah,
don't let someone tell you, oh, this is really good, like some kind of snob. But if you like it, then drink
right.
it. And this is, I think.
City of Saints. Can I see that bag?
Yes.
It's cool.
Yeah, simple. So, are you looking at the tasting notes?
No, I didn't look at the tasting notes.
You didn't look at them,
I didn't.
Okay.
I was just looking at the picture.
Okay.
Or I didn't even realize they were on the front.
Well, okay. So, let's cheers and okay. taste it and see what you think.
Cheers.
Very good.
Mm, I like that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That's really good.
How would you describe the notes? It was roasted just a week. I mean, when we received it, it had been roasted like 3 days before. So the fact that we got it through through Drink Trade did not delay
really
the roasting
good.
At all. It's not, they don't send it to Drink Trade and Drink Trade sends
right.
it. Drink Trade just like directs the coffee.
Oh, okay.
So they tell City of Saints, hey, these people in Illinois, they ordered, you know,
yeah.
Two bags of Broida Estate, and then City of Saints just roasts it and then sends it straight
wow.
to us. So really fresh.
I'm gonna
what are
say,
you tasting?
Like caramel?
Caramel. Wrong. No. Probably the closest thing to that is stone fruit, which we have seen before.
Is that close to caramel?
It's sweet.
Okay.
Yeah.
These
are a couple of the more unusual. There's one tasting note that I have never heard of before. I had to actually look it up.
I don't know. What are they?
The three tasting notes for this Broida Estate coffee are stone fruit, baking spice, and genmaicha.
Yes, genmaicha.
Genmaicha.
I was almost gonna guess that.
Yes, I have no idea what that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I don't know what that is either. Should we look it up?
I did look it up.
Oh,
and
you're prepared.
Yeah, it's a Japanese green tea made with brown rice kernels.
Oh, interesting.
And I lived in Korea for a while, and it may not be the exact same thing, but there was a thing called nurungji, and which is a It's a really cool concept because it's the rice that stuck to the bottom of the pan, and instead of throwing it out, they kind of burn it even farther, like scorch
yeah.
the rice. And of course, when you're making rice in a 5 or 10 gallon pot, you've got a lot of, you know, it really adds up to,
right.
to a lot. So you scorch it, and then you pour a bunch of water in there, and then you boil it, and the water just takes on the flavor of this very subtle flavor of like burnt or scorched rice, kind of toasted rice, I guess. And they have it as a soup, but you can also drink it as tea.
Oh, wow.
It's very, very...
Did you have it?
I did. I really liked it.
You liked it?
Yeah.
It sounds like something you would like.
Yeah, it does. And I was told by... I was told by some friends of mine in Korea that it was an old man food. It was a food that an old man likes.
That makes sense.
And also a drunk food. But I just, but they said, oh, you're kind of like an old man because you
yeah.
like nurungji.
Well, you like I know that you like the taste of like
burnt things,
stuff,
right.
And you also like not wasting food.
Right.
So that's
it,
like everything that you like.
All the boxes for me. But I don't know if I can. If I think about it really hard, I could probably taste it in this coffee. But this coffee to me
yeah.
is very fruity and bright and sweet.
Yeah,
and
it is very sweet.
And I love it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't really, that wouldn't have been one of the first things that came to mind because that rice soup or tea is very subtle. And this coffee really isn't subtle. I will also be honest with you that I actually cheated and I was drinking this earlier in the week because we got it a little while ago. But what I want to say about this coffee, there's certain coffees that are really high-end and complex and stuff like that, but you have to make sure that you brew them the right way, and you have to make sure the water temperature is exactly right, and you want to make sure that you're using the right kind of water and the right exact right amount, or else it can be a little too strong or too weak. This coffee, for whatever reason, as I was brewing it, because I mean, and I shouldn't admit this, but it's true. I don't as as particular as I can be about coffee, I never measure it. I just kind of like eye it all the time. So I'm always doing, and with the water and with the amount of coffee. Now the grind is always the same because we, in the studio here, we have a burr grinder, which is, has a setting. And so it's always exactly the same, which really does, that consistency helps the coffee taste a lot better just on average. But yeah, I'm always dumping like different amounts in the filter and then brewing it. And every time I did that, this coffee tasted amazing.
Yeah.
It wasn't like too weak, too strong. It was just really, really good. And so I would say that the City of Saints coffee is hard to mess up.
Yeah, that's a good selling point.
It is, because not everyone has time to like get out their little wash the tablespoon measure from yesterday and dry it out so that expensive coffee grounds don't stick to it. And then, you know, I mean, I just don't do that. I dump it in there.
I feel like this is like the beginning of like a infomercial. Don't you hate having to rinse out your coffee
with the black and white
spoon?
Where someone like drops it and then they like look really sad. Just a little more about City of Saints while we're drinking this wonderful coffee. Let's see. Sourcing is very important to them, the relationships that they have with the farms and with the companies that kind of oversee the farms are really important. They actually mentioned names of these companies. There's Genuine Origin Coffee, there's Onyx Green Coffee, Royal New York, and Pergamino. This is kind of like a world that I haven't really ventured down much. So, but it was cool to see that they were very cognizant of the companies that help them get certain coffees from different countries. They had a lot of details about that on their website. This is a washed processed coffee, the one that we're drinking right now. And the altitude is between 1700 and 1850 miles above, or must be meters above sea level. Yeah. Harvested in September 2020. And the roaster, a little note from the roaster, which I think is neat. It says, approach. My approach to all Indonesian coffees, which Indonesia is just like on very, very close to Papua New Guinea. My approach to all Indonesian coffees is the same. I want to find a balance between sugary, sweet, roasty flavors, which this is just nails, and the bright, spicy, earthy complexities of the coffee's terroir and varietal. With this delicious PNG, finding that balance is easy. We roast this coffee pretty light, showcasing a delightful stone fruit acidity, but we still manage to bring out a nice spice and chocolate finish that creates a very sweet, bright, and round cup. Baroida always produces coffees that are super complex and tasty, so as a roaster, my goal is just to be nice and gentle, letting the work of the producers stand for itself. So kind of sounds like the roasting process is the same as the brewing process, which is that the bean is already really pretty good.
It's like the super bean.
Must be a super bean, yeah. those are my findings on City of Saints.
That's very interesting.
Visit their Instagram. You know, they got a lot of beautiful pictures, and they like to kind of like do a lot of lighthearted stuff. They do have a few cafes, two in New York City, which have been closed for much of the coronavirus pandemic, and they have not opened yet, as far as I could tell. I think their cafe in Hoboken, New Jersey, is open now.
So are they all on like the East Coast?
They are, yeah. Okay. As far as I could tell, even apart from any pandemic stuff, they have two locations. They have one in Brooklyn, one in Manhattan, and then one in New Jersey.
Okay.
So, and I think they do the roasting in New Jersey, if I remember right. So, but it all kind of comes back for City of Saints. It's like, drink what you like. I mean, again, it's a lot of work that they put into roasting the coffee, obviously, and getting beans from the right place.
Well, they can confidently put that on their bag because it would be very hard not to like this coffee.
It's a very likable coffee. Yeah, it really is. And like I said, I mean, just a really cool first experience with drinktrade.com.
Yeah, that's a really cool, thing.
Model. Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, for anyone that likes to drink high-end coffee regularly and to try different things, I can't think of a better way. Because again, like I said, a lot of the coffees I've found have been through their website. So that I found for this podcast. So I really encourage people to check it out. If nothing else, just get the 50% off first time.
Yeah.
You know? And this is not promoted. I mean, they didn't send us any free coffee. We went through the normal channels just like a normal customer would. But it was such a good experience that I could, you know, definitely wholeheartedly recommend this after that. So
awesome.
That's cool. Yeah.
Well, so, thank you.
Of course. Yeah.
Thanks. That's yeah. Thanks for talking about all that. And
I don't know where the name came from, City of Saints. I that might be a New Jersey nickname. I don't know. But
I'm not sure.
I didn't see on the website anything about the origin of the name.
Interesting. Well, you were talking about the City of Saints, mm-hmm. and today we're gonna do a crime from the City of Angels.
Whoa. That's pretty cool.
It is cool.
How is there always such a close connection?
Okay, before we start with this though, I remember the last time we did a podcast, we were talking about icicle murders.
Yes, and I've been taking so many pictures of icicles recently because I've seen some doozies. I've been thinking about
There's some big,
I mean, everything's melting where we live now. But wow, like we had this cold spell for a few weeks and with a lot of snow and then with like melting, intermittent melting. And wow, I mean, I saw some 3 and 4 foot icicles that all I could think about was like, could this penetrate a human heart?
Great. So I actually looked up, like I was trying to find a icicle murderer.
Yeah.
But all I could really find was just people, like when I Googled it or whatever, people talking about how icicle would be such a good weapon for murder.
Yeah.
So maybe in the future we'll have one to talk about.
Okay.
But
one of our listeners, Rachel Aubrey, she posted a video where a guy tests on like a piece of meat or something.
Okay.
He tests an icicle. Maybe we'll have to watch that on the podcast because it was interesting. But yeah.
So did it? It worked.
Well, we'll have to wait until another podcast.
I also like saw a lot of stuff about people getting injured from icicles.
Well, you could easily see how that would happen. Yeah, so, especially if it falls from like 20, 30 feet and hits you in the head, or oof, it's kind of bone chilling.
Yeah,
pun intended.
So we are going to
today is not the icicle killer.
No,
case.
It's not about an icicle. I mean, it takes place in Los Angeles, so it'd be very hard to get an icicle.
Yeah, it's been a while since they had icicles around here.
Yeah. So today we're actually going to talk about Stephanie Lazarus.
Okay.
Does this name sound familiar to you?
No.
Okay. So the reason I chose this one for this week was because, you know, we've talked about on the podcast before about how I like to watch interrogation videos.
Right.
And this was one that I have seen before, but I, like earlier this week, I was like, I just like really wanted to watch her interrogation video.
Yeah.
I was just like, you know, I don't know, just had it in my mind that I wanted to watch it. And I started watching it, and I actually watched it like twice this week just because like when I was driving to work, I just like had it on playing, like, you know, it's just interesting.
Yeah.
It's a good one. So if you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. But
what's it called again?
Stephanie Lazarus.
Just it's called her name.
Yeah. Okay. And then interrogation video or whatever. Okay. Yeah. All right, so let's get to it. Stephanie Lazarus, she was born on May 4th, 1960 in Northwest LA in a city called Simi Valley. Have you ever heard of that?
Yes.
Simi Valley. Stephanie's parents divorced when she was a child, and she and her brother Stephen were raised by their mother, and she never really had much of a relationship with her father. You know, he was kind of estranged from her from an early age. Mm-hmm. So growing up, she was very athletic. She competed in basketball, track, and tennis in high school. She was such a gifted athlete, in fact, that she actually played on the boys' tennis team in high school. There was no girls' tennis team, so they let her play with the boys just because she was so good at it. She was also very gifted academically. She did well in school, and she had the goal of one day becoming a lawyer.
What could go wrong?
I mean, I can't see anything going wrong. This is the thing. We talk about a lot of people, like murderers, who are very smart.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some very dumb ones, too, but...
Yeah, that we don't choose those.
Maybe we should find the dumbest one for
when I was a kid, I had a book of, like, the dumbest crimes about these criminals that would come in and then, like, apologize to the bank for robbing them and then get arrested and just really goofy stuff.
That's funny.
It was a fun book, I remember.
You still have it?
No. It might have been a library book, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I better not still have it or else I'm the criminal.
Dang, you're going to have a large library fee.
Yeah.
All right. So after graduating from high school in 1978, she went on to UCLA. And I think that's a hard school to get into.
I mean, now it is. Well, I imagine isn't
that,
it was then.
Isn't that the one where like all those celebrities were bribing the college officials to let their kids in?
Yeah.
Like Aunt Becky and
yep.
whoever else they were.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, she was very, very smart. So there she studied political science and psychology, and she also continued to play basketball for 2 years at UCLA. So in college, she was very popular. She lived on the 10th floor of a dorm building for her first 2 years of college, and there she made a lot of lifelong friends. Hmm. One friend in particular was a tall, handsome electrical engineering major named John Rutten.
Okay.
John Rutten. Sorry. So Stephanie had a very active social life, and she dated a lot of guys, but John was the one guy who really caught her attention, and although the two spent a lot of time together, unfortunately for Stephanie, she had kind of been, you know, friend zoned mm-hmm. by John.
Yeah.
So he almost saw her as, you know, kind of one of his bros, you know, more than, you know, a love interest. However, eventually Stephanie kind of wore him down and the two started dating. So it was pretty obvious to everyone around them that Stephanie was more serious about the relationship than John was. He saw it as more of kind of like a casual fling. He didn't really see any long-term, you know, wife potential in her. But she was very much in love with him.
Hmm.
So it's always a recipe for disaster.
There is a theme starting to grow here, yeah.
So, you know, kind of by the end of John's, you know, by his senior year, the relationship had kind of fizzled out due to his lack of interest. However, the two remained friends.
Okay.
And they would still hook up on occasion,
hmm.
which is probably never a great idea.
Yeah.
So John graduated and started his engineering career in the spring of 1981. And 1 year later, Stephanie graduated and landed a job at a law firm. So she was still trying to decide at this point if she wanted to actually go on to law school or not. And then after working at this law firm for a while, she decided that it just wasn't for her.
Mm-hmm.
So she ended up enrolling in the police academy instead.
Hmm.
So in 1983, when she graduated from the academy, she began working as a patrol officer for the LAPD.
Cool.
So, you know, doing
well, that's
good.
An intense job.
Yeah. I mean, that's you imagine
being a... Because she was like on this.
Yeah, she was on the beat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really, wow.
Yeah,
in the 80s.
Yeah, in LA.
Wow.
Yeah, so Stephanie and John not only remained in contact during this time, but they still kind of continued their on and off, you know, hookup relationship while also seeing other people.
Mm.
So they were both dating other people, hooking up once in a while, just kind of, it was very casual. But of course, you know, Stephanie still had these really strong feelings for him, and he was, you know...
Yeah.
She was kind of just like a time filler for him.
Yeah.
You know. So in the summer of 1984, Stephanie learned that John had met a woman named Sherry Rasmussen. That's Rasmussen, not Rasputin.
Okay. Good. Good distinguish that.
So Sherry was a tall, attractive blonde, and she was a nurse at a hospital in Glendale, which is about 10 miles north of LA. So like a 4-hour drive from LA.
Yeah. Exactly.
And John had fallen head over heels for her. You know, it was kind of like a love at first sight thing. You know, he had spent all this time with Stephanie, kind of off and on, not really mm-hmm. feeling it. But as soon as he met Sherry, he was like, this mm-hmm. is it. So Stephanie...
Starting to see how a crime could happen here, potentially.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Stephanie was extremely jealous. And she had always assumed that once John was done kind of, you know, sowing his wild oats, that he and Stephanie would end up together, get married, and live happily ever after.
Mm.
But instead, John had pretty much, you know, cut off all communication with Stephanie.
Yeah.
And was focusing on this new relationship. So during this time, Stephanie still had hopes that eventually they, you know, he would break up with Sherry and, you know, she would still have this happily ever after. But those hopes were shattered in May of 1985 when Stephanie heard through the grapevine that John and Sherry had gotten engaged.
Oh, boy.
Back in those days, they had to hear things through the grapevine.
Yeah, that's...
There was no social media.
No face vine. Just grapevine.
That's how you find out that your exes are getting married mm-hmm. nowadays or... whatever.
Someone mentions it on the phone, on the telephone landline.
Yeah. So after she heard the news, she was so distraught that she called John crying. She was upset, and she asked if he would meet up with her to talk.
Weird.
Yeah. So he agreed, and Stephanie came over to his place that night.
Okay.
So she basically just laid it all out. You know, she cried. She told him she had always been in love with him. You know, please don't marry this girl. You complete me. Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And, you know, John was pretty straight up with her. He told her that, you know, it was over between them. He was in love with Sherry. He was going to marry her. But that night, he decided that before he left, or before she left, he would have one last hurrah with Stephanie. And right, he ended up hooking up with her in order to give her closure. Because that's a good idea.
Yeah, that's always the best way to end that relationship.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
that you're just like
he might have brought some of this on himself.
You're just like sprinkling fertilizer on the crazy at that point.
Yep, yep.
You know, just
pouring gasoline.
Cultivating it.
Yep.
So after that, you know, as you can imagine, Stephanie was thinking there was still a chance.
Yeah.
So you're telling me there's a chance. you know, and she was trying to call John, hoping they could get together again, you know.
He's like, what have I done?
Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, he was moving on. So after being ignored, she decided to attempt to break up their relationship another way. And later that summer, she went to Sherry's work at this hospital and told her that she and John had hooked up.
Which was true.
It was true. Obviously, Sherry was upset and an argument between the two ensued. And Stephanie told her, if I can't have John, nobody will.
Boy, I literally that phrase like entered my mind about 5 minutes ago.
Yep.
In this escapade. Wow.
So later that night, when Sherry gets home from work, she confronts John and he admits to hooking up with Stephanie and he begs for her forgiveness. He tells her it's completely over between them. It'll never happen again. And he will never even speak to Stephanie again. Like,
yeah,
it's done. You know.
Yeah.
So Sherry ends up forgiving him. And they move forward planning their wedding and end up getting married that November. So a few months later, they get married. So, you know, the newlyweds are happy, you know, they're living in a nice condo and they've, you know, moved on from this. And it actually appears that Stephanie has moved on as well.
Okay.
So, you know, people are living their lives.
It's just going to be like a happy ending story.
And that's it. So during the next few months, Sherry confided in friends and family members that she felt like someone was stalking her. She kind of had this feeling like she was being, you know, watched or followed. And not only that, but Stephanie had actually come to their place a couple times, you know, asking for John or, oh, I'm supposed to meet John. He wanted to talk to me.
Yeah.
So just like...
invasive.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've never had that feeling of someone watching me.
Really?
Yeah. People always talk about it in books and movies and stuff. But I've never... maybe no one wants to watch me, which is nice.
That's interesting because... maybe you're just so used to people watching you.
No, but even when I was a kid, like I'd, you know, like I've heard that phrase and it's never resonated with me on an experiential level because I've never felt someone's like staring at me right now and I don't know where.
But that's
coming
the thing,
from.
Like people stare at you all the time because you're a performer.
Not when I was a kid, though.
Well, yeah, but. Yeah.
I mean, and I, you know, I wasn't really popular in college until like later on in college. So people weren't looking at me then.
Huh.
I don't know.
I always feel like people are watching me.
You do?
Not because they like me or something, but just because
feel
I'm
self-conscious.
I'm just like paranoid and self-conscious all the time.
Yeah. Huh, interesting. I just wanted to mention that that's never been like something I understood that well.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, oh, someone's watching me.
Well, Sherry Rasmussen understood it very well.
Okay.
Because, you know, she had this creepy feeling. And she said that she even thought that Stephanie had been dressing up like a man and following her around. Because she would see this kind of like weird man that, you know, didn't look quite right. So there was like a lot of weird stuff going on. But when she told her concerns to her husband, John, he thought she was just being paranoid. Like, Sherry, like you're just, you know, you're thinking about the past and things are good now.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. So on February 24th, 1986, just 3 months after Sherry and John got married, Sherry wasn't feeling well and decided to call in sick to work. So during his workday, John had tried to call her a few times, but she never answered, and by the afternoon, he had started to get concerned. So he left work early and came home to check on her. And when he walked through the door, he finds Sherry dead, laying on the living room floor in a pool of blood.
Wow.
So she had been beaten, hit over the head with a large vase, and shot several times.
Whoa.
And he also discovered that her car was missing. So John obviously calls 911, and the police come and begin their investigation. So from the scene of the crime, they determined that she had been shot by a revolver, that the killer had used a blanket to muffle the sound of the gun.
Yep.
They also determined that a major struggle had occurred. There was stuff thrown everywhere. Sherry had lots of defensive wounds, and that pointed to the fact that Sherry and her killer had physically fought before the shooting.
Yeah.
And they even found a bite mark on Sherry's forearm.
Wow.
Yeah. So they end up taking a swab of this, hoping to get some saliva. So remember, 1986, DNA was just kind of beginning.
Yeah, it's around that same time as the Clint case.
Right, exactly.
Where they didn't even call it DNA, they called it something else.
Yeah,
but, yeah.
Genetic testing. Yeah. So in a lot of cases around this time, kind of like the Clint case, they were collecting evidence kind of in good faith that one day they would be able to figure this out.
Exactly. And a lot of cases have been solved.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was like good, you know, forethought to do this, even though they kind of knew that nothing was going to happen with it right then.
Right.
But yeah. So, you know, so the first person that they look at, obviously, as her possible killer is John. You know, he's the husband.
Right. It's always the closest.
Yeah, he was the last one to see her, all that stuff. However, he was quickly ruled out as a suspect.
Alibi.
And I think just like the way he was acting, obviously he was extremely distraught.
Yeah.
And so they started to theorize that it had been a burglary gone wrong. So there had been a lot of drug-related robberies and violence in the area.
Hmm.
And, you know, beyond John, they really didn't know where else to look because Sherry, you know, seemingly didn't have any enemies. But her parents actually brought their concerns about John's crazy ex-girlfriend to the police's attention. So her parents were like, you know, John's got this ex-girlfriend. She's been bothering Sherry. Look at her. However, they didn't think that it held any water, and to make things more complicated, Stephanie was one of their own.
Yeah.
She was part of the LAPD, and they just couldn't fathom something like this.
Yeah.
You know? So they didn't really ever entertain the idea. And what's more is that just a few weeks after Sherry was killed, a burglary occurred in the same neighborhood where two men had pulled a revolver on the homeowner.
Yeah.
So they didn't shoot her, but this occurrence really, you know, cemented the idea that this is what happened to Sherry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, similar situation. It's got to be these two guys. But unfortunately, the men were never apprehended.
Mm.
They never found them. They were never arrested. And eventually the case just went cold.
Yeah.
So now Sherry's parents, they never gave up on the possibility that Stephanie was involved. And they kept, you know, calling the police, going there, saying, have you looked into this? Have you looked into this? But every time they asked the police about it, you know, they just kind of dismissed them. And one time, one of the detectives even told her dad, you watch too much TV.
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like, you know, go away.
Right.
So,
in the meantime Is she trying to rekindle things with John? Like, after?
Not like right away.
Yeah.
But months after the murder, Stephanie and John do end up speaking.
Okay.
A couple of times. And a few years after, John even agreed to meet Stephanie and another friend in Hawaii for a vacation.
Hmm.
You know, so there's kind of, they never reconnected romantically.
Yeah.
But they're still like, you know, kind of friends. They see each other, talk once in a while.
Clearly, he doesn't think that she is the killer.
No, I don't. Yeah, I wouldn't imagine he would go on vacation with her.
One would hope not.
I think that the police probably convinced him like this was, you know, a burglary.
Yeah.
You know, we know it was because of these, you know, this other situation that happened right after. And you know, couple years go by, Stephanie's doing very well in her career, and she had even been promoted to a detective in the LAPD. And later, she moved to Oregon for a while to work in the DARE program. And you never went through the DARE program.
No, I was homeschooled.
I remember the DARE program.
Do you?
Yeah.
What's the thing you remember the most about it?
Did
you get like sports cards with like German Shepherds on them and stuff like that?
Shepherds?
German Shepherds are like drug sniffing dogs.
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't get that.
I think at garage sales, I've seen like DARE sports cards.
Man, I got the Shaft.
Yeah. I think a friend on Facebook.
I got a t-shirt.
I've seen the t-shirts too and the bumper stickers.
Yeah. I think they quit doing the DARE program because I think it made kids like want to do drugs.
It made kids think about drugs.
Yeah, when they weren't thinking about, I mean, what fifth grader is thinking about drugs?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So she moves to Oregon to work in the DARE program, and it was here where she met a fellow officer, Scott Young, and the two end up dating, and they end up getting married in 1996.
Wow.
Yeah.
So she's finally over John.
She's moved on. She's met Scott, and they end up adopting a daughter a few years later.
Okay.
So that's nice. So she eventually came back to the LAPD to take a high-paying position in the art fraud division.
Whoa.
Which is really interesting. So it's a like a department that specializes in the theft of fine art.
Yeah.
So it was Stephanie and one other detective that were, you know, placed in this department, and so it was like a big deal.
Yeah.
You know, very, you know, prestigious position.
Yeah. What year is this again?
This is like in the late 90s, I believe. Late 90s, early 2000s. Okay. Yeah.
She's like 40 years.
Yeah, old. Yeah. So she was very well liked around the department. You know, people described her as generous, supportive, and vivacious, although others claim that her office nickname was Spazarus due to her erratic behavior when she got angry.
Mm.
Spazarus.
That's a good nickname. Yeah. Don't say it to her face.
Stephanie
though.
Spazarus.
Or else she'll Spazarus on you.
Yeah. So in the early 2000s, the LAPD was starting to look at a lot of cold cases.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, due to all the advancements now in DNA technology.
Yeah, they've had it for a while at this point.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the cases they began to look at was the 1986 murder of Sherry Rasmussen. So DNA had advanced so much by this time that they were able to put together a DNA profile based on the swab they took of the bite mark.
Yeah.
And discovered that the person who left the bite mark was a woman.
Okay. Not the men that they thought.
Right. So at this point, they realized that that's not a possibility.
Yeah.
In 2009, detectives finally begin working on the cold case again. And this time, given the evidence that a woman has, you know, committed this murder, they were forced to look at Stephanie as a possible suspect.
Right.
So further investigation.
Are the parents still alive at this point?
Yeah,
and they're probably advocating for
right
for
exactly.
This
yeah. Done, yeah, and they I mean they never really stopped.
Yeah,
they always kind of kept you know hey,
that would be so hard.
Is there anything new?
All those years. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well.
So further investigation revealed that Stephanie had been off work on the day of the murder, and just a week after she reported her gun stolen. The same gun used in the murder.
That should have been looked into.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, I think the fact that she was, you know, so high up in the police department, they just, you know, and I don't know if it's so much like they didn't want to do it just because of that, but everybody knew her.
Yeah.
They were friends with her. They probably just didn't think that she was capable of it.
Yeah.
So.
Hiding in plain sight.
Yep, exactly. So the only thing was that they would need a DNA sample from Stephanie.
Mm.
And they don't want to come right out and be like, hey, we need your DNA.
Well, no one wants to deal with Spazarus.
No, we're going to get
that's
going to
be the Spazarus of all time. Tyrannosaurus
the grand
Spazarus.
So basically, police officers followed her around undercover in order to retrieve something that had her DNA on it.
Mm-hmm.
So they were watching, waiting
just
for her to
follow
like
her to Mickey D's.
Exactly. So that's basically what they did. They followed her around. And in the spring of 2009, they followed Stephanie to a Costco where she threw out a cup.
Mm-hmm.
So they retrieved the cup. They analyzed the DNA. And it was a match.
Wow.
Stephanie Lazarus was the one who bit Sherry.
Very interested to see what her explanation was of that DNA matching. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
I feel like we should have an intermission here in another episode.
Let's talk about the coffee subscription. So on June 5th, a couple of the... Save it for June 5th.
So, yeah, that's
on June 5th, a couple of the LAPD detectives told Stephanie that they needed her help with an art theft case. And they ended up taking her down to the jail where she had to surrender her weapon at the door to walk into the jail.
Oh, that's really smart.
Yeah. So they did this intentionally because they did not want Stephanie to be armed when they questioned her.
Yes. Because at this point, they know she's a murderer.
Right.
Yeah.
And she's a spazzeress on top of that. Yep, so. So once in the room, the detectives actually, they had set up a hidden camera ahead of time. So Stephanie did not know that this was being recorded. I mean, she should have, because she's a detective. Yeah. So they begin to question her. So the interrogation video starts with her walking into this room. There's a camera, kind of, you can tell it's hidden. She's sitting down. They're just kind of like, hey, you know, we don't actually need your help with an art theft case. The reason we brought you down here is because, you know, we're looking at some cold cases. This one came up. You had a connection to it. We just want to, you know, question you about...
A very strong connection. Your saliva was in a woman's body who was dead.
But at this point, she didn't know.
This interview, now that I know the context, this interrogation sounds fascinating.
Yeah, you need to watch it.
I mean, this is really good. This is like one of a kind.
It's really good.
Wow.
And she's so weird in the interrogation because, you know, they start asking her, you know, did you know this guy, you know, John Rutan? Mm-hmm. And we've talked about interrogations before and kind of like how people act when they're being deceitful.
Yeah.
And a lot of times people will just, they're giving all kinds of details, but they're going off on these tangents.
Yeah.
And they do it because they want to, A, get the person who's questioning them kind of off the path.
Yeah.
And also they want to appear like they're being really forthcoming.
Yep.
Like, wow, this person's telling me everything about their life.
Yeah.
Like, obviously they're not holding anything back.
But to the... Even like an untrained person like me, it really, because I've watched those and it's like, it's really, it gives more suspicion than anything.
Right.
You know?
Right. And she like, she never answers questions. Yeah. Every time they ask her about anything, she's always like, well, that was a million years ago. I don't remember. How can I remember that far back? What year is it now? 2009? Oh, that was a million years ago.
A million years ago.
And she keeps acting like she's trying to like remember things. And it's just like, oh. You know, eventually they're asking her, do you know anything about his wife? Do you know how she got killed? Do you know... You know this, and she's saying, no, I don't even know if I ever met her. I don't remember. Like, this is so long ago. I don't remember. And so finally they tell her, like, we actually have DNA evidence now in the case. And she's like, oh, well, good. Well, hopefully that'll help solve it.
Yeah.
And so then towards the end of the interrogation video, she starts to get kind of like irritated.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I think you guys are trying to pin this on me now. This is crazy. Yeah. I can't believe this. She's like, I'm going to talk to a lawyer. And then she gets up and they tell her, you know, you can leave the interrogation room. That's fine. So she walks out the door and she's arrested immediately because they have her DNA.
Yeah.
So, and then I saw her her booking photo.
Yeah.
And she's smiling like a total creep.
Weird.
Yeah. And she's got these like crazy eyes.
Ooh,
yeah. Wow. She's just a, yeah. So the trial began just over 2.5 years later, on February 6th, 2012, the prosecution had a cornucopia of evidence. So they had DNA evidence. They had
motive, for sure.
They had motive. They had the gun. They had opportunity. And the defense presented an interesting argument that she had been framed. So they said that the DNA sample had not been properly stored. It was in a torn envelope in a freezer. And they said that someone could have easily gone in there, tampered with it, or replaced it, or whatever. And they were like, well, they probably did that because they were just like wanting to solve this case. So they're just trying to, you know, pin it on Stephanie.
Yeah.
Or they said, you know, maybe somebody that she worked with wanted revenge upon her.
Right.
So, but I mean, yeah. So the trial lasted just over a month, and on March 8th, 2012, the verdict was read. So the jury found Stephanie Lazarus guilty of murder and she was eventually sentenced to 27 years to life. So in 27 years, she'll be up for parole, possibly.
Okay.
And how old will she be in 27 years from 2012? So she was like 51 when she was sentenced.
Okay.
So, 70, I don't know.
78.
Yeah. So, I mean, she'll be like, you know, she'll be older if she does get out.
Yeah.
But, so in 2015, Lazarus ended up appealing the conviction, but it was upheld.
Okay.
So she's still serving her sentence in the California Institution for Women in Corona, which is probably some place you don't want to be right now. But yeah, so that's the tale of Stephanie Lazarus.
Wow.
And I encourage everybody to watch that interrogation video.
Yeah.
Because it's very interesting and it's funny.
Yeah. How long is it?
Like a little over an hour, maybe.
Okay.
Like an hour and 20 minutes or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you for all your research.
Yeah.
When did you first hear about this case?
Oh gosh, that was a million years ago.
Well, I feel like you're not telling me.
I can't even remember that far back. No, I think I had first heard about it probably watching a show, you know, a crime show, like Snapped or Deadly Women or something.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, and then going through my interrogations, this was one of the ones I found.
Yeah.
So
when she said to Sherry, when she said, if you can't have him, no one will, I thought she was going to kill him, because that would be the
right,
way, that would be the only, the best way to make sure that no one has
right,
him,
because
is,
I mean,
if he's dead. But so I thought originally that she was going to go after him.
Maybe
she probably loved him still and couldn't.
Yeah, she did. Maybe her original plan was to like kill him.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe she was plotting this for a long time.
Because it's weird, because like after she killed Sherry, it wasn't like she like immediately was like trying to get him back.
Right.
Like, oh, your wife's dead. Like maybe we can like give it another go.
Right. I expected that too.
Yeah.
Didn't happen.
I mean, maybe she was hoping that he would come back to her.
Yeah.
Or maybe after the murder, she was just kind of like wanting to distance herself from the whole situation.
That's probably a good guess too.
So I don't know.
Wow. So Jessica Lazarus?
Stephanie.
Stephanie Lazarus. Stephanie Lazarus. That is the story of Stephanie Lazarus.
Yes.
From Simi Valley, California.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
All right.
That has been our Coffee and Crime for this week, everyone. Thanks for listening.
I hope we're back next week. I'm going to try really hard.
Yeah, and I am ready whenever you are, because,
okay.
And I have a really, I'm not going to give too many details because I want it to kind of be a surprise.
Maybe you could just mention like the tasting notes.
The tasting, well, the connection I have with our next coffee is actually someone I know personally who has become a pretty like well-known roaster.
Yeah.
In the coffee roasting
world.
We
got connections over here.
And so we're going to have an interview with my friend, which is going to kind of come right before the podcast. So,
awesome.
It's really, really exciting.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, that'll be a very special episode.
It will be. Yeah. Keep listening, everyone. We're coming up on our year mark. You know, we started.
So crazy.
We started late March of 2020.
It feels like less than a year, but it also feels like more than a year. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. don't forget to check out drinktrade.com for a subscription, coffee subscription, you know, goodness. It's a really cool option, as well as specifically the coffee that we had today, which was a Baroida Estate from Papua New Guinea, City of Saints Coffee Roasters. And it's really good stuff. Tasting notes of Genmaicha tea, stone fruit, and baking spice.
Genmaicha. It's very interesting. Genmaicha. Oh, I just thought of something. When was the Night Stalker happening? Was this around like this time, like 86? I think it was.
That sounds about right.
And that was in LA.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm sure that was like a huge focus of, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So
all
that,
those people.
Yeah. So that probably took the focus away from a lot of other stuff that was happening.
And of course, she was all for it, the focus being
taken
off. Yeah.
We got to figure out this Night Stalker thing. Let's not worry about this other
case. This needs to be our priority.
We just watched
Netflix.
Yeah, it was really, it was good.
Four. Yeah, it was good, but just
it was
really,
yeah, it was really very frustrating and just terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, especially it didn't. No. It wasn't the ending that you want.
No, for
something like that.
Yeah.
You don't want a killer to be like idolized by people, and unfortunately, that's what happened.
And then we won't give the rest of it away because you should watch it if you want, but just prepare to be really disappointed.
Yeah. This has been Coffee with Crime. I'm Lewis.
And I'm Alexi.
We'll take our coffee
with crime.